are back, ladies and gentlemen, to Out of the Main. We were born at sea and raised on radio, and we are back for part two of our interview with Neil Steubenhouse, bassist extraordinaire.
Yeah. I put the podcast at risk. The complete history and future of the podcast was at risk because I dared to present a counter-argument to our guest, which I know is probably a no-no. Would you think so?
I think at the professional podcast convention, there was a whole talk on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you stay for it?
No.
Okay.
No.
Then I guess we were able to go ahead. So I'll set this back up. Neil was discussing about his influences coming from New York, very intense, very sophisticated, very heady music that he was absorbing. Came to LA, and at the time, what we know as the yacht rock or the session musician circuit was in full bloom, and he didn't have a lot of knowledge of the players because it didn't really catch his attention what they were doing, whether it was too bland by comparison to what he was listening to or whatever. But eventually, obviously, he learned how to fit in, and so I asked him about keeping your best licks in your locker and saving little bits and little nuance for the right moment, but for the most part, having to sit in a pocket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he gave an answer, and we come back this week, and I had a little counter-argument to present to him. And as I said, we don't know at this point whether he walked out of the interview at that moment or not, but we're about to find out.
Let's find out.
So let me give you a counter argument to that. Not an argument to it, but using your own work as an example, because I'd like you to follow up on, you know, a great bass part to me often is something that when I listen to the song, to your point, I don't immediately go, wow, that bass player is blowing it out. But if I go back and say, okay, I'm studying Neil Steubenhouse, let's see some of the tracks that he's done, and I'm focusing strictly on the bass part, then all of these other brilliant things are revealed to me. You know, so the bass part is able to not be noticed when you don't need it to be. But I'll give you an example, and you can tell me maybe about the session or the design of this bass part. When I had never once really paid attention to the bass part of the Commodore's Night Shift. Until I started to study this week and said, well, what did Neil do on that one? Oh, it's fretless. And if you listen to that song and just focus on the bass part, it's bass solo quality going on there. I mean, it's a brilliant part with the double stops and all the things that you do in that.
Jackie.
So that line was an intentionally very active line. What do you recall about that?
Not much. it's like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I think that I overdubbed on that. And they were just reaching out for different ideas. So nobody told me what to do, is my recollection. And I just tried things. And I think Vinny played on that. Am I right?
I think it was Vinny, yeah.
And they didn't micromanage him either. And he added little tiny nuancey things. Cause again, it's this, you know, it's the song. But my gut was always to overstep on the first run through.
Yeah, that's right. You did say that. Yeah.
Cause worst thing that's gonna happen is they say, okay, that's overkill, that's too much. And that way you get the musical thoughts in your head out of your system. And that happens a lot. And if on a first take, you get those musical thoughts out of your system and you overdo it, and they like this, this, and this, and this, great. Then you just help to add compositionally to the song. And that's probably what was going on then. It was really a long time ago, but
yeah, I knew it would be challenging, but it's a brilliant part.
I'll give you another example to drop in, John, a song that I've heard a million times. We've probably talked about it a few times, but go back and let's listen to a little bit of the bass line in Pages, You Need a Hero.
I got news for you. Nothing's lost if what we have.
So I don't know if you've done that recently, John, but
no,
I did not. As recently as today. And that's a part that's really fun and clever to listen to in its subtlety. What do you remember about that session?
You Need a Hero was added when the record company was frustrated with Jay Graydon over something I had known nothing about. And they went back to Bobby Columbia, their original producer, and they asked them to add two tunes. So I think it's Jeff Porcaro on that, right?
I believe so, yep.
Yeah. So we got to a small studio with Steve Kahn, I think, was on that, as I recall, who's such a genius guitar player, underrated, in my opinion. This guy, oh my God, just know. And I guess the vibe was right, and Bobby never told me what to play. So I just played whatever I thought was going to work. And, you know, remember, there's a couple hours to do it. I think we did two tunes.
Yeah.
So.
But you liked it like that, huh? Where you had to knock it out first, second take fairly quick, huh?
You don't have to. It's where they accept it.
Yeah.
You're just going to keep doing it. And if it feels great by the second or third take, because you really, as you go on the first take, you start to know what didn't work or might not have worked, and you try something different. And once you're locked in, you know, it's, Vinny and I always call that, it's peaking now.
Mm-hmm.
That was our line. Because there's a point where you're still getting creativity, and then on the downside, it's getting stale. And you're repeating yourselves. And what are you going for, really? Some kind of magical perfection that nobody hears but you? Listen to all those records, the Motown records from the 50s. They did a song. They did three songs in a three-hour session. They're not going to pay any more than any overtime. And there's mistakes. And give me a list of people who give a shit.
I just did.
Exactly.
Right. And really, the business never learned that. Record producers who got picky, they never learned that. That all these people out there listening, they don't hear that. They don't know.
We get fascinated by them. We hear things that we think are mistakes, and we're fascinated by them because they're still in there. And we know the reason that they're still in there is because of what you say. You know, it's instinctive, yeah, and the rest
in there
of it.
Because nobody cares.
Right.
I love it when people tell me, well, you know, I wish I could have produced Stevie Wonder because I would have cleaned up this and cleaned up that. Oh, you would have, would you? Really, you're going to clean that up? Because everybody noticed those flaws.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's arrogant.
Yeah.
And it's a pomposity that is a problem and always was in the business. Because when Steely Dan started perfecting and using, the first drum machine and all that, everybody thought they were Steely Dan. You know, that's their process. That's their artistry. When the Bee Gees started using a loop and making perfect disco records, you know, seriously, you know.
Let me ask you, Dale, if we could go back to what you said about how you might approach a session on a song, knowing when to start to add maybe some layers or finesse or complexity. John and I always chuckle at the observation. We think it's the coolest thing in the world that every musician seems to save something for the fade out. So it's like, all right, I got a really good lick, but it only belongs 3 seconds before we're faded to nothing. Is that an approach that you even articulated? Or was that, again, just an instinctive thing of being a musician? Like, we know when to do this and when not.
It's instinct to know that it no longer matters in the body of the tune. That you can go for it and they can get rid of it. They can cut it out. So plus, you're having fun because you got a perfect take, you know, or close to perfection as it's supposed to be, and it's really good. And now you're just going to have a blast in the fade. And if they don't like it, they don't have to use it. So now you're just, you know, it's just kind of a relief in a way.
Yeah. It feels like a game to us. Yeah. Like you're trying to get away with something.
Well, I was going to save this for our lightning round, but since we're on the topic,
it's eating dessert.
Yeah. You know? Let's listen to some, John, I was going to save this for the lightning round, but we got to do it now. So the end of OCOE off that same Pages album, listen to what some of the licks that Neil sneaks in here at the end. We'll be right back. I don't know if you remember that, Neil, at all, but there were some good little juicy tidbits there.
That's not forgettable, so I remember it.
Well, that song, what's cool about that is that song is so tight with you and Jeff, you know, it's rhythmic and it's syncopated. You guys are so tight. And at the end, you get that chance to,
what? Vinny Caliuta on that, I think.
Oh, that's Vinny?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Vinny.
And you were right, it was Steve Kahn on and You Need a Hero.
Yeah, so that was, those were after sessions when the record company kind of, I have no idea the backstory with Jay. I know it was problematic, and those were difficult times in a way, because it was so creative and we were so excited about it. And Vinny was still, you know, let's call it a novice at doing studio perfection work. And Jay Graydon is at the top of the heap of it's got to be exactly the way he hears it, because God forbid anyone else, you know.
No one hears like Jay. And OCOE, like, by that time, the Pages were on their third album, so it was make or break, you know, so I'm sure there was some pressure there, too.
Well, yes and no, because they had switched record companies.
Oh yeah, I mean, okay.
It was make or break from the first record and the second, which were both brilliant. And the third one, you know, these guys are writing, you know, Fagan quality, and the market just doesn't understand it. You know, they don't understand it. It's too sophisticated for many. And I recommended Vinny. I wanted Vinny. We rehearsed a few times and everybody loved it. And Jay was already into his marriage to Jeff Porcaro as a recording, you know, a recording, You know, that's everything in his world. It's perfect. He wants simple, perfect. So there was only two songs, I think, that Vinny made on the record, and he recorded every single one. Every single one. There's a Vinny version.
Oh, no kidding. Oh boy.
Yeah. Interesting. And I have cassettes of it.
Huh.
They're probably melted by now, but
do you remember the session at all to with speaking of Jay, I'm kind of making this up as I go here, for Breaking Away? I know you played on the title tech track Breaking Away. Breaking away. Your love has opened eyes that couldn't see. Breaking away. Your beacon in the night is I listened to that this past week, and it's funny because I think that's probably Foster on the piano, and there's a very distinct, punctuated left hand in the verses, and you're just playing like short staccato notes, and I'm thinking, this is all he got to do? And then the chorus comes, and it's boom, and it's like these two sides of, okay, I got to lock in because that's what the rule is on this verse, and I'm following, you know, Foster's left hand, but then the chorus comes and you're set free. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, if you only knew.
Oh, no.
Well, you're here to tell us.
Yeah.
If you can. Yeah,
I don't know if you guys have enough time.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
It was early 80s, I guess, and I had this, I had just bought a VW Rabbit, and Jay books this studio on Melrose that's in a funky area, and I park in the back. It's a 7 o'clock session. Jeff, David, and me. And Jay comes out and he says, "Stu, will you just wait in the waiting room? I want to just cut Jeff and David first. 7 a.m., 8, 9, 11, midnight.
Is there at least a pinball machine in the waiting room or something? No,
1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. 1 a.m.
Oh, my. Oh.
Jay comes out. Okay, we got the track. Stu, let's go to my house and do the bass. I'm just going to pack up and... And I got to go to bed. So it's 1 a.m. We get out of there at 2 o'clock. My car is broken into in the lot, windows smashed, stereos stolen, and I'm feeling just great. 2 a.m., I haven't played a note. Jay wants to do it at his house. Okay? We go to Jay's and say, "Oh, I'm sorry about your car, man." we're both sorry.
That makes two of us.
And I get to Jay's house. And he microscopically, you know, had me record everything. I mean, I don't care if he hears this. He knows what he does. And everything was picked to the bone from between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m., which is when I left his house. 2:30 maybe I got there.
It's a nice song.
This is reel to reel. So he's got to do tones, and he's got to do a whole bunch of stuff.
Is he engineering it himself, or does he have a cat with him? I can picture him doing the whole, like, running the tape and the board.
He had Ian or somebody, I think.
Okay.
Don't remember. But so my car is smashed. It's 2 a.m. It's past my bedtime. I have work the next day. And so whatever the track was, I don't know. I did the best I could. If you can hear it, then you got good ears, because Jay takes the low frequencies from God knows what cycle on down and just wipes them out.
Yeah, I noticed that on those Juro records. They are light, thin in the end.
And I always have to struggle to hear.
Yeah.
To hear the bass the way I want to hear it. And I think I'm not alone. Most people other than bass players want to hear a little bit more bottom end.
Yeah.
And you can hear the difference on You Need a Hero and on the Pages record to some of the other tunes where it's a J. Graydon mix. You can see it.
Oh, okay. Within the same album, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to do that today.
Yeah. That's Jay's style is it's very concentrated mid range.
Yeah, yeah.
I noticed it, but not being sophisticated enough to understand why. I thought it was just a different master, because we notice on Spotify, which is how I listen to it, the singles sometimes seem like they're different masters than the rest of the records.
That is often true. But Mark Jordan's Blue Desert is another example, has that same tonality that Neil's talking about.
Does you? Yeah. Well, maybe we should end on a high note then,
So in other words, the backstory is complicated, and what I played on it, I tried to help it along. Jeff nailed a great groove, but Jay, it's not just me. He nitpicked the heck out of them, the two of them, Jeff and David. I mean, for 6 straight hours.
Well, we know we spent 3 hours with Jay on a half hour interview. So we know.
That's right. I've spent 3 hours with Jay and never saying a word.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, what about a session or a finished product that you are particularly proud of, or one that was memorable because it was so good or fun? And if it's hard to pick one, I have one to ask you about, but I'll let you offer one first.
Why don't you ask one first?
The Flashpoint record with Tom Scott. That seems like it was a fun album to play bass on.
Every album I did with Tom was a fun album to play with, no matter what. Always fun. Always. I mean, I credit with Tom with really kind of getting, helping me get started. Tom never, or I would should say rarely, depending on whether, what the circumstance was, he never restricted me. And what he got was sometimes things he didn't expect at all. And I, like, the first time I played with him on one of the songs that Jeff and I, that was failing, we were playing it and it was just miserable and everybody was, getting high and what have you. And I just started playing it at a completely different tempo with a completely different bass line.
Oh.
And everybody woke up and Jeff kicked in. And Jeff kicked in with like that goodbye look drum part.
Yeah.
And boom, we were off and running. And that was what started my experiences with Tom. And he loved it. They were just all smiles and, pot influenced smiles, but all smiles.
It's still come.
And every record I ever did with him was, I had a lot of control. Tom referred to me about musicians and about things, and you know, we got along great.
To your credit, you must have great self-restraint then, as I could say, as a fellow bass player, because I don't think I've ever heard anything where I thought, God, he's overplaying there. It always seems to service the song, going back to what you said earlier. So good job. And you're representing us bass players quite well.
That's a group effort. That's everybody deciding, yeah. And a lot of times I'll self-decide and say, oh, that doesn't fit at all. You know, and then you hear what you're going to do for me, and you hear the licks that Anthony plays at the end, and it's like the world just changed, you know. And everybody starts to stretch out a little bit for attention, but let's face it, we're not, you know, I'm not Anthony Jackson.
That's right.
You got to be Anthony Jackson. So
know your ability and know your limitations.
Yeah.
Well, I had one more thing to add, Tom. I know you're asking about, we got together on Christmas, or for our family Christmas. The two of us are brothers, and our other brother, listener Mike, as he's known on this show, is also a bass player, sax player, bass player. And we were just kind of, this is pre-studying, you know, we knew your name. We see it come up, and, but actually before I sat down and studied, I just said, what's your initial impression? What do you think of when you think Neil Steubenhaus? And I wrote down what my initial impression was. And I think this conversation bears this out, Tom, if you don't disagree. I wrote that I hear echoes of Jaco refined into a simpler style to fit into the world of popular music and service the song. There's still a fusion side that wants to speak out every now and then. That was my assessment.
That was my upbringing, you know, and I met Jaco when he got on the plane. Pat would fly him to Boston, and he would come with his with one bass, not two, no case, no shoes.
There's pictures of him from on the New York subway like this.
No shoe. Yeah, but that was later. That was like, That was from the illness. If it's the timing I'm thinking about.
Okay.
This is 75. And the buzz is starting to go around. You better go to Zircon tonight and see the Pat Metheny Trio. You got to hear this guy. It's insane. And so we went to see him, and it was insane. It was insane. So that changed the face of, in my opinion, that changed the face of electric bass playing, because
across the board for everybody.
Now it's, I mean, this guy comes along and he has innovations that you can't even count on one hand, all wrapped into his style on electric bass that you never heard before. Never. And we got to be friends. I actually bought a couple of acoustic 360s. Every time he came to town, I was the lender. And sometimes I lent him a bass if he didn't bring a bass. I mean, this is a guy who carried around the cheapest little gray patch cord, you know, the Switchcraft one with the
curly one?
The angled end, not even curly.
Oh, the angled end. Okay. You
know, he couldn't care less about any of that. And we were mesmerized. So everybody's learning Portrait of Tracy. Everybody's learning, you know, all the tunes from the debut record. And we became friends enough that when I auditioned for Herbie Hancock in 77, we met at the hotel. I had about 45 minutes with Herbie, which was mind blowing. And then it was worse, because then I get out, Jocko's in the hallway. He puts the headphones on me. You got to hear this, Neil, man. You got to hear this. And it was Heavy Weather.
It was
Birdland, and it was Teen Town. And, you know, basically your head's exploding. This shit is another level of brilliant from a bass playing and a song level that is cracking new ground.
This is before it was released. He had a cassette for you here?
Oh, this is on a cassette.
Yeah.
Way before it was released.
Wow.
They had just finished.
Wow.
Wasn't even mixed. And he's playing me this stuff, and he's dancing in the hallway and doing this thing. And it's insane. And And so we were friends, you know, we played his version of racquetball in Florida, and he played me stuff at the house, you know, when he was married to Tracy. and that influenced everything, I guess, is the answer to your question. How could it not? But I learned early on when I watched all these bass players come up and they were imitating him exactly and playing fretless exactly. And I thought, that's not going to work. That's not going to work, because that's not Jaco's playing is for that stuff, you know.
For him.
For everything that's right. him and that works around him and the stuff that he's right. created. And so, but could I take it out? Not a chance. I'll tell you the bass player who I think influenced more people than anybody pre-Jaco was Paul Jackson.
Okay.
You can hear Paul Jackson's influence is in Jaco. It's in Abraham Laboriel. It's in almost every R&B bass player that I hear post James Jamerson and you know, post Paul Jackson. Paul Jackson couldn't read a note. He couldn't play anything. I never saw anybody more instinctive in my life just coming up with something and it making. He made the song. He made all those Herbie tunes. He created that style. I think it was all Paul. And I noticed his playing in so many bass players. And uncredited, I might say, because I don't know who else besides me is calling it out loud, but Jaco played Paul Jackson's stuff. Everybody did. Everybody took a piece of that, because it was all style and instinct without forget soloing chops or anything like that.
Thinking theory wise.
He played on this song called A Spook That's, it was for a movie called A Spook That Sat by the Door. And it was on in Downbeat magazine. It was a ripoff.
Oh yeah, I remember those. Yeah,
with Butterfly and some other tunes that were post the Chameleon record, that were Herbie, and Harvey was gone on it. It was Harvey was on it. It was Harvey playing those songs. 2 years later, that song is called Actual Proof, and they're still playing it today. Everybody plays Actual Proof. It's a Herbie classic for an unusual tune with an unusual form and an unbelievable bass line. The bass line on the plastic record was a one-bar bass line that went boo, 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 bit, boo, bit, boo, 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 bit, boo, bit. That was Paul's bass line. Herbie told me this story straight, that when they got to the studio a year later with Mike Clark playing drums, Paul played a new bass line. Right off the top of his head, it was a two-bar bass line. It was do 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 do. Every bass player plays that bass line. Every bass player. It's required material. Paul came up with that bass line on the spot. On the spot. And Herbie had to change everything because he geared the song around a one-bar bass line.
And he recognized that this was so good.
Now it's a two-bar phrase.
Yeah. Wow.
Herbie adjusts, changes everything, and that's all, they still play it live today because Actual Proof turned, Vinny and I used to always say, Actual Proof. That's it. That's the name of the game. It's in one key, and then he has this little move, and then it's a step higher. Nobody knows. It's the most genius tune. There's no bridge, there's no nothing. It's just 16 bars. And it's,
wait a minute, no four, bridge.
Or 14 bars, no bridge.
That fit right in today then.
Well, remember the genius tunes that had no bridge are the Wayne Shorter tunes. There's a zillion of them, 60s. After Wayne started writing for Miles, all those songs, like Footprints, there's no bridge. That's genius. It's all, Wayne wrote 12-bar tunes, Nefertiti, and Fall. These tunes are just They're pictures.
I feel they're like pictures. I'm back at Berkeley. I remember all of these lessons.
They're images, and they're genius. They're not dumb four-bar tunes that are just the bridge is the same as the chorus, and you got the different lyrics. It's not like that. It was sophisticated, advanced songwriting, and that was actual proof. Paul Jackson influenced everybody, including Jaco. I'm positive about it.
All right.
And you can hear it in a lot of, you know, Jaco added a lot more to it, but it's all there. It's all there. The little fret move. Abe Laboriel has got tons of Paul Jackson.
Well, I feel like I went to bass school today and I didn't have to pay the Berkeley tuition to do it. So that feels like stealing, Neil. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Wow.
We'll have to have you back because I have a feeling there's more in the chamber for stories you got.
I told you this is great. Too much, but you know,
there's a lot there, man.
It's impossible to look at, you know, 40 plus years and just say, well, this session was fun, because a lot of sessions were fun that never saw the light of day.
Well, some of the not fun ones were interesting stories too, talking about the grading thing. So they don't all have to be fun to be interesting now.
They were, you know? Fun. They were fun. And I don't want to get it wrong. Well, no, breaking away wasn't, you know, and
the fun, but
$1,200 repair to my car, which is more than I made on the
set. Yeah, $50 for the session or whatever the rate was back fun. Then.
but a lot of the stuff that had, you know, conflicts and things involved were still the meat of and potatoes of it were always fun. It was always
We're learning from all of that, you know, whether they're good stories or bad stories. That's why we suck this stuff in. We do this podcast to talk to you guys and learn this stuff. Yeah. We're not doing the podcast for the money, I could tell you that. We're doing this so we can talk to you guys.
I understand.
Exactly.
That's it. Yeah, you did. Well, I'm sure.
I'm going to ask the final question for the bass players in the audience, and that is, what was your acts of choice during the the Pages Sessions era, and what's your acts of choice to this day? What are you playing?
It's another can of worms. I had a Fender Precision that I added a back jazz pickup on way before there was a PJ. That was my instinct, because I always thought that the Precision bass split pickup worked on more records than a jazz bass did, even though that's subjective, and a lot of people will say no. And you know, we could talk to a lot of players about it who use jazz bass, but that was what I thought was the magic combination to add a little bit more depth and have the back little mid-range thing. James Tyler, who was the manufacturer who made the basses I play now, he did all the modifications to it. We went back and forth a zillion times fixing wiring and nonsense. It was a bastardized P bass. That's what's on the Pages record and most of those, until it got stolen in 1980.
Wow. Every artist has a story about something getting stolen, whether it was Jack Bartley's guitar.
I have several, but
Kenny Loggins'
tapes. I didn't get that back. My car, my car was targeted. I left it in the back, covered for a half an hour, and I had a Toyota Supra with these fancy leather seats, 1984 Toyota Supra. It had seats that were worth way more than the car. I don't know why. I couldn't tell you their marketing reasoning, but it was a Jaguar, basically the seats. So I got out to my car, and the car was on four blocks, and everything was gone. Front seats, back seats, gone. They sold on the aftermarket for $7,000. Car was worth $3,000-$4,000.
Wow.
And they took that. The bass was in the back. I had advertisements everywhere. I looked for it. I searched for it for months. I put an ad in every music store. So my theory is, a car thief, his kid has my bass.
Yeah. Yep. And he's probably doing four chord songs with it.
That's
no bridge.
That's my theory. it might never have seen the light of day. And James Tyler rebuilt me a Precision jazz exactly to what we did with that one. But of course, nothing is exactly the same.
Right.
Ever.
True.
Ever. And that was the bass of choice then. And the five string that he made me in the early 90s is my choice now. because it sounds the best. I've played basses that play a little bit easier and are, but I, the way that bass sounds is always commented on. And he duplicated that precisely with the same Dan Armstrong wired pickups, who's long gone deceased. And Dan Armstrong wired the pickups on that P bass that was stolen also. A genius, a crazy genius. I don't know. Do you know who Dan Armstrong is?
No,
I do not know.
He was famous in New York before you guys were born. And there was a store in the Village that every guitar player went to. It was Dan Armstrong. That was the name of the store.
Oh, okay.
Everybody went there. Everybody in every band anywhere. And he did the work. And everybody also went to Seymour Duncan later on. And he did the pickups for Jeff Beck and for Clapton. You name
it. It's like that Mike Kuntz guy here in Detroit, be, where anytime right, someone
right.
stops
it had to be
in,
Seymour. Yeah. And yeah. those years, it had to be Dan. Dan Armstrong wired those pickups in his kitchen for me. The precision pickups, because the five-string bass, nobody figured out how to get a balance with five strings because it's a two and two. So electronically, they're balanced. He figured it out. It's his pickup in this bass. We matched it for the bass that James built to duplicate it. Not the same. Not the same.
Yep. Well, never Rod is. Story's the never one that is. Got away.
Yeah.
Well, my ears are better than I thought, because I was listening and I thought, that sounds kind of like a P bass, but not quite. And I was actually right. So I'm glad I asked. So thank you for the long answer. And thank you for being here again, Neil. We will definitely have you back thank another God. Time. Get more stories out of you. And until then,
if you want to fill in any details, you know, let me know.
We will do that. All right. Thanks again, Neil. All right. Thank you once again to Neil Steubenhaus, especially for coming back for two parts, because now I really feel like we're tipping the scale in this contest between how many bass players we have on the podcast and how many drummers.
Yeah, we've gone bass dominant in the last year or so. There's no question.
We have. And funny thing, next week's episode is going to be about a certain somebody who started his career on bass. How's that for a cliffhanger?
This is true.
All right, let's hit the lightning round, shall we?
Yep.
Okay, super easy peasy for me.
Found well, it. I have no found it, Sue, so I'm going to defer to you, and then you get to boomerang around or snake draft.
This is
going to
be great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to the Breaking Away album, the Al Jarreau masterpiece.
Okay.
And I'm even going to use the track Breaking Away, because we've got Neil Steubenhaus on bass, and it just doesn't get any better than or yachtier. Than being found at sea with Al Jarreau. Let's listen to it.
So yeah, now we get to hear a little bit more. We only had the little snippet before, and it's good to expound on. Sometimes it's difficult to pick up on the nuances of what a bass player is doing, even for somebody who knows what to listen for. So it deserved a second go around for sure.
Yep. That's got Jerry Hay. So some of the names that you might recognize on that particular song, Michael Boddicker's on there, Jay Graydon, of course. So it's very yachty. It's very found at sea, and it's worth repeating. All right. Buried Treasure, have you?
I do.
All right, let's hear it.
You want me to go? I thought we were snake drafting.
All right, well, I'll go again.
Go ahead.
All right, I love it. Buried Treasure, doing a little research here. Again, last week we mentioned how Neil Steubenhaus plays in a lot of different genres, right? But here's a Buried Treasure from Billy Joel's album, 1986. That was The Bridge, right? Mm. Do you remember this hit? It was a single. I don't remember it, but it's called Baby Grand. It's a duet with him and Ray Charles, and the song is written about the glories that are a baby grand. So you're not going to hear a ton of really great bass flourishes, but it's yet another style for Neil Steubenhaus.
When I'm lonely, she comes through. She's the only one who can. My baby grand is all.
I'd forgotten about that tune. Yeah,
that's why it's a buried treasure, my friend. Right. So apparently they got together, and Billy contacts Charles about the naming of his daughter, Alexa Ray, after Charles.
Yeah.
And that's how it sparked this conversation. They decided to collab.
Wow.
Yep. All right, buried treasure. Should I do my final thought now?
Here No, you're going to do this? Yeah, you're talking about great bass flourishes.
Mm-hmm. For lack thereof.
And earlier we were And earlier we were talking about tracks that deserve a second spin, second attention. We need to put more focus on what Neil did, fretless, on Commodore's Night Shift. We visited this song a few times in the past. We visited it just in this interview with him. But we need to hear a little bit more of it because the fretless part on this tune is absolutely stellar. Top to bottom, hit it.
Well, I had rediscovered, listeners, you may remember, that song in season 4.
Yeah.
Brought it up as a buried treasure. Now I can't either. It's so good.
And that's before I even knew that Neil was on it. Now I pay attention to the bass. I've got yet one more layer to just be infatuated with.
Yep. Great fretless. Again, the many styles that is Neil Steubenhaus. All right. Final thought.
All right. So that snake draft puts me back on final thought.
Yep.
Why does my final thought never get to be final anymore?
Well, I am once again letting Neil Steubenhaus have the final thought.
Okay, well, this time then I would say for people to come back next week. We're going to paddleboard our way further out into deeper waters. It's getting dangerous now. We're moving further away from the yacht. But we're going to study one of the great sonic minds of the 80s. We teased that we were going to start getting into discussion about some of the production techniques, the sounds and things of the 80s. Well, this is... I think in many ways that this is a guy that defined the sound of the 80s, but the good side of what the sounds of the 80s are. And we'll dig deep into that. But this guy is the guy when you think about great sounding records of the 80s.
And we're not going to say who it is?
No!
Okay. Well, I already said, though, that he started out as a bassist in a bar band.
Well, try and put the pieces together.
Search bassist, bar band. You'll probably actually come across my name. Anywho. All right. Well, let's let Neil have the final thought on his approach to playing bass, because you mentioned the stuff about the locker, mm-hmm. in and out. And I came across, it's not an instructional video, it's an interview he does from back in the 80s. You'll see from his hair and from the recording quality. But and he talks about throughout this entire interview, his approach, and I just thought this was interesting and might be worthy of paying forward to fellow bass players. Here it is.
We can all practice, you know, all kinds of scales and pentatonic scales and what have you. You know, we all know a lot of those kind of things, and we can practice all those little things, and they can all be part of soloing in context of a song or, you know, a jazz kind of context, but really, if you really want to be noticed in the solo world, it's really a matter of just thinking of things that are just not ordinary. So you can play a solo, and if you want to copy a saxophone player's, you know, idea of melody and everything, then it's going to sound great. I mean, you're going to sound like a great soloist. Is it unique? Is it memorable? You know, maybe, maybe not. I think the most important thing really is to just find unusual things. Which is why I like to just hear. Unusual notes, dissonances, mm-hmm. and things. You know, in all honesty, I'm in situations where I'm required to be a soloist maybe 5% of the time. For me, I love being supportive. I can play 20 minutes straight just playing a great groove if it really feels terrific and there's different little things happening on top. If it's not going anywhere, it's good for 2 minutes. If it's going somewhere and constantly moving and there's interesting harmony or other things or rhythmic things that are changing on top, then it's, you know, that to me is the best fun I could possibly have.
Okay, well, who gets to say ahoy polloi this week?
What's ahoy polloi?
Ha, it was you.
You said it first.